One of the commentators that I've been reading on the book of Leviticus asked rhetorically, what worse fate could fall upon us than to read of the gory details, the minute details, the bloody sacrifices, blood everywhere, and the arcane practices and rituals that we find in the first five chapters, and answers his own question by reading them again in chapter 6 and 7. And so that's what we're faced with this morning. It may feel a little bit like a same sort of ground that we've covered. But we're going to find out that God has good reason for covering this again. With the length of today's text, I'm not going to read every verse as we normally would. We have covered all five of these offerings over the first few weeks of our preaching on Leviticus. I want to really draw out two applicational themes that I think present themselves to us. I'll read some of the text, but not all of it. I do want to go over the structure, though. These themes do come out of this text, and I don't just want you to trust me in that sense. I'd love it if you read this afternoon, but I will present very quickly the structure with making just a few comments as we go through. On the slides, you'll see this. Firstly, from verses 8 through 13, there's the burnt offering, and in this case, we see a maintenance also of the altar fire and the mention of the disposal of ashes and the ordinances around that. From verses 14 to 18, there is the grain offering, which is to be a pleasing aroma. It is a pleasing aroma to the Lord. The priests are allowed to eat the remainder, and it's considered a most holy offering. There's a second part to that, a 2b, the priest's grain offering. This is from verses 19 through 23. None of that is reserved for eating. Probably not surprising. The priests, in a sense, are giving up something. It would not seem right that they would take some of their own offering in return. From verses 24 to 30 of chapter 6, we see the sin offering. Priests again shall eat of it. It's the same location on the bronze altar as the burnt offering is found, and it is also considered one of the most holy offerings. In chapter 7, turning there, from 1 through 10, we see the guilt offering. This is a food offering to the Lord, and I know Pastor Andrew covered that this is not like the pagan worship that would be literally, they felt, feeding their gods. This is a food offering to the Lord, not really for the Lord, not certainly for his consumption. We do not sustain the Lord in any way. He is self-sustaining. From 11 through 21 in chapter 7 is the peace offering. And all who were clean may eat of this. This was a general provision across the camp. Then we have a little bit of a cutaway from verses 22 through 27. And this is where, again, all of the people are addressed. And this is, to quote Mr. Hall, the fat is the Lord's, as Pastor Andrews told us of his dad. No blood, no fat. All right, quite simply. Back again to a peace offering, this time the priest version of the peace offering in verses 28 and 36, and then a closing summary. It's that simple. All right? Closing. It's going to get more complicated, you know it. All right. So what are the differences? Why is the Lord, in a sense, going over these five offerings once again? Well, up to chapter 6, verse 7, we know that it's the people that are being addressed. These were addresses to the people through Moses. The Lord, right in chapter 1, verse 2, says, I'm speaking to you, and I want you to speak to the people. And it was instructing them in terms of what their responsibilities were, what these offerings were for, what did they represent. And the priests, of course, are charged with leading and conducting these services. So we see a shift here from verse 8 in chapter 6, where it's the priests that are now being addressed, almost right to the end of chapter 7, other than that little cutaway I mentioned where there is the prohibition against the fat and the blood. So we see these detailed rites regarding disposal of ashes, the cleaning of garments, types of garments for particular tasks, reusable and not reusable bowls, and where and when a sacrifice may be eaten, what day it may be eaten, at what day it's past its sell-by date, and you have to burn it up. It can be a little dizzying. All these laws, though, they emphasize and they support the attention to detail and strict obedience to God's instructions that were expected of the priesthood and the layperson. Otherwise, as in chapter 7:18, verse 18, the one who would offer it would not be accepted if it was not done in the way that was pleasing and right before the Lord. Now, this could lead us to wonder, I think, what kind of God did they serve? What kind of God cares about what his priests wear or the kind of bowls they use, etc.? Well, our God does. And our God is the same God that they serve. The God of the New Testament is the God of the Old Testament. And I think to reduce this to chapters on just nitpicky details, as if God is placing his faith in form and form alone, is to really colossally miss the point. Observing form only with a rebellious heart, we know that's not of any use now. We have that expression, God looks upon the heart, because that's really where the treasure is, right? And we know that as Christians. But in the Old Testament, it didn't work any better. I was thinking of Saul when he was called to defeat the Amalekites and to destroy them utterly. And he led and the people followed in the setting aside of certain things. The king, for one, Agag, but also choice things of the land the people wanted. Now, of course, when Samuel confronted, Saul said, well, we were keeping those best things for the Lord. We were going to make a sacrifice before the Lord. And Samuel got right to the point, to obey is better than sacrifice. To obey is better than sacrifice. So God was not placing his hope and faith, if you will, in the form. It was always about the attitude behind the form. On this, I think Calvin writes really brilliantly. So this is his little part of his commentary on chapter 6 and 7. Since God prefers obedience to all sacrifices, he also leaning on the Samuel interaction there with Saul. Since God prefers obedience to all sacrifices, he was unwilling that anything should remain doubtful as to the external rites, which were not otherwise of great importance, that they might learn to observe precisely and with most exact care whatever the law commanded, and that they should not obtrude anything of themselves. Obtrude is a bit of a fancy word. You're going to learn a new word here from the pastor. Obtrude, it just means to impose inappropriately. God did not want the priests imposing themselves, either their attitudes. He didn't even want his worshipers to be so self-conscious that they took their eye off the ball, so to speak. The rites and the observance of these rites were meant to free up the people, if anything, to worship, to keep themselves out of it. I think Calvin has that right. Now, you may still be unconvinced, and we've acknowledged this, how distancing these sacrifices are to the Western mindset, to our current modern-day mindset. And we know that blood sacrifices, surely, and particular priestly garb are not something that we fall under today as obligations of the Christian faith. I get it. And we're not, certainly, Pastor Andrew and I are not looking to make us more rule-bound. But I think sometimes this term Christian liberty, that we take our Christian liberties too far, in a sense, that we take license in matters. And not just in the sense of holiness, but also, I think we're really challenged this day in terms of reverence. One of our values as a church, our stated five values, is reverential, to be reverential in our worship toward the Lord. I think the that the tendency sometimes is to have a license towards sloppiness. And it's even sometimes garbed with that's being more spiritual, to be sloppy and unprepared. The Anglican theologian, shout out to my Anglican friends here, Gordon Wenham, I think he makes a great point in this regard, and this is almost a direct quote. Jesus himself said that God must be worshipped in spirit and in truth. It has become commonplace to contrast spirit and form as if they were competing interests or incompatible in worship. One might quote, "The letter kills, but the spirit gives life," and do so out of context, but it is sometimes used to justify sloppiness in the leading of services and other Christian activities. Or spontaneity and lack of preparation is somehow equated with spirituality. And I think Leviticus 6 and 7 denies this. God is more important, he says, more distinguished, worthy of more respect than any man. Therefore, we should follow his injunctions to the letter if we respect him. Jesus himself said, "If you love me, you keep my commandments." So we don't have this sense of spirit working against truth or spirit working against form. There's also the example of the arts. Julia Nellum works behind the scenes at the Grand Theater. Many of you know that. I don't think I'm betraying any private confidences here. She can tell you that, you know, when we go to see a performance, and these are artistic sorts, right? The types that might be against rule-boundedness and details. Well, when we sit down before a wonderful performance, or like the classical music conference my wife and I are going to enjoy at the beginning of May, I'm really looking forward to it. We sit down and we enjoy this beautiful performance. It's taken a lifetime for those performers to get there. If you ask them, "How much did you practice for this?" many would say it's a lifetime. I've devoted myself to my instrument or to my craft. We go over and over and over these things, so much so that we get out of the way in the performance. The presentation is what captivates people, not me. So that sense of not imposing ourselves into something where we're not really supposed to be. Does that make sense? Well, our two themes. I said two themes. Firstly, I think this one's a pretty obvious one, that we are to keep holy things holy. To keep holy things holy. Obviously, as we get into, if we got into the details of the passage, it is pretty evident, this sense that there's unclean and clean, and there are unclean practices and clean practices. There are vessels that are used in the conveyance of these, the effect of these sacrifices to the people and the priests, even down to, you know, the ashes that would accrue due to these, to the burning. The ashes would accumulate on the side of the altar, and from time to time they would need to collect them and remove them to outside the tabernacle. Well, they used different garments for that. They would pick up their ashes, remove one garment, put on another, take the ashes outside. Those garments, that garment particularly, would be then unclean. It wouldn't re-enter the tabernacle. So this sense of what is clean and unclean pervades the sacrificial system. And the priests were called to keep holy things holy. So today, with today's text and all its details and regulations, what was God communicating to his people in these rituals? Even in the space of the tabernacle, what did that communicate? Space and time and the context that we're in conveys things, doesn't it? Lynn and I were just in our time away down in Williamsburg, Virginia. And I'm a lover of history, so you can imagine I had a great time down there, the so-called birthplace of America. Virginia being, at one point, probably the primary of the 13 colonies. And at one point, we entered, had the privilege of going into the governor's palace. Williamsburg was at one point the capital of Virginia before Jefferson in 1781 moved it to Richmond to be further away from those nasty redcoats. But at the time, this is colonial time, so this is before the Revolution. The king is on the throne in the hearts of the colonists, and the governor's palace conveyed something. So if you had audience with perhaps the governor or one of his representatives, you would first come into a very grand, certainly for that time and era and place, foyer. That foyer was magnificently paneled in wood and relief and molding all around. On the walls were symbols that conveyed something of the empire to these people as they walked in. If they didn't look up, they'd look down first because the floor was marble, something very unusual at the time. So it conveyed wealth and prosperity. On the walls hung, I want to say possibly hundreds, Linda could correct me if I'm wrong, but at least dozens and dozens of swords of different sizes and shapes, pistols and rifles. What's that conveying? Probably a bit of both protection and authority. So here's the kingdom that backs you, but it's the kingdom you don't want to cross either. And then, as I said, various emblems that all would convey something to that visitor. So what was the tabernacle itself? As they encamped about it, this picture reminds us that we are still in the shadow, basically, of Mount Sinai. So this, even though it's a long book, it occurs over a short period of time. People have camped around the tabernacle. This is before they head off into the wilderness in the book of Numbers. So what's it conveying? What understanding developed in these in godly Israelites? Well, certainly the holiness of God. We find all of these rules mystifying, if not sometimes downright offensive. Why in the world should my appreciation of a good medium rare steak cast me out of the camp? Really? Like, what does that have to do with holiness? We can dismiss it either as offensive or maybe even unsophisticated, right? We're surely beyond that. We're not unsophisticated in that way. We're above it. But I think what we miss then, if we dismiss it or are offended by it, is what is being taught by these practices, the purity, the majesty, the transcendence, the authority, the power of our God, of their God. He may dwell with us. It's a great picture, isn't it? God dwelling with his people. He may dwell with us, but to do so, he comes down from a very high place with which we are not familiar. You do not know God as he is unless you fear him and love him. And I know that sets our hair a little bit on edge. We don't like that word fear, do we? But when we see it in a proper biblical sense, and not just in the sense of reverential, which is sometimes what we reduce that to, I think there is a trembling that rightfully comes to us. Pastor Andrew has talked before a great image of when you stand, I grew up in Niagara Falls and worked right across from it for 4 summers. When you stand at the edge, it's both captivating and drawing, but it is terrifying at the same time. And I think when you understand God for who he is, and we see ourselves as we are, yes, it draws us that he is captivating. We see he is our only hope. And so that draws us near. But it's not someone that we feel that we can be chummy with, even though he's a friend that sticks closer to a brother. Does that make some sense? Hopefully we'll unpack that tension a little bit more as we go through the rest of this. You know, it may be precisely because so many Christians no longer are careful to embody reverence for God in their worship that they struggle to comprehend the holiness of God and why holiness should matter so much to him and to us by extension. Not to mention the world around us that increasingly struggles with even the notion of divine judgment. This has seeped into the church massively, and even modern evangelicals. What they like about God and what they preach most about God is his love and not his holiness. And I wouldn't mind that so much if it was actually a biblical love. But it's such a reductionist love that really reduces God to basically your life coach. It's just going to tell you nice things about yourself and make you your best self. It's not a biblical God. Derek Tidwell says this, I think, concisely and really well. God's holiness made it essential and makes it essential to us that we approach him with caution, reverence, humility, and awe. Now, that's not to say, you know, maybe he should add joy to that. I would add joy. But maybe in our culture, we need a lot more of the awe and the humility and the reverence and the caution. So we see the holiness of God. I think we also see the sinfulness and the impurity of men. Four of the five sacrifices secured atonement in some sense, which in the language of the Old Testament meant the forgiveness of sins. And it's a point that's made on a number of occasions. The sacrifice of an animal, the laying on of hands on said animal before it was killed, the blood splashed everywhere on the altar, the meat cooking and the sending of this aroma through the camp and heavenward. All of this spoke powerfully of the need to secure forgiveness from God. The fact that there was always morning, noon, and night a burnt offering on the altar spoke of Israel's constant need for the mercy of God because of their sin. Now, that's a good segue into our second theme. We depend on the presence of God. We keep holy things holy. And here's the great news. And this is the news that really is started with in Leviticus 6. I've kind of preached this a little bit backwards. The emphasis is really on verses 8 to 13. It sets the table for everything. God, both Old and New Testament, calls us to be a holy people. Be holy as I am holy. And that has got to be the most terrifying statement in Scripture. Without God's abiding presence, without his enabling presence, we depend and we need the presence of God. I'll read verses 8 to 13 if you wish to follow. This is from chapter 6. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Command Aaron and his sons, saying, 'This is the law of the burnt offering. The burnt offering shall be on the hearth of the altar all night until the morning. And the fire of the altar shall be kept burning on it. And the priest shall put on his linen garment and put his linen undergarment on his body. And he shall take up the ashes to which the fire has reduced the burnt offering on the altar and put them beside the altar. Then he shall take off his garments and put on other garments and carry the ashes outside the camp to a clean place. The fire in the altar shall be kept burning on it. It shall not go out. The priest shall burn wood on it every morning, and he shall arrange the burnt offering on it and shall burn on it the fat of the peace offerings. Fire shall be kept burning on the altar continually. It shall not go out." Perhaps you've noticed three times we see the emphasis to keep this fire burning. So not only is this an instruction, a re-instruction of the priests in the burnt offering in general, specifically they're called to keep the altar fire burning. It shall not go out. Three times we read this, verses 9 and 12 are similar to 13, which states, "Fire shall be kept burning on the altar continually. It shall not go out." And what does fire speak of? Probably more than one thing, it'd be fair, but I think primarily it does speak to the presence of God. And think through our scriptures, front to back. God revealed himself to Moses where? Through a burning bush, firstly. To Israel in fire on Mount Sinai. We find this in Exodus 19. The cloud that encamped about the Mount Sinai and the fire that burned even speaks of God speaking with fire. He led Israel by cloud by day, by fire by night. The prophets Ezekiel and Daniel compared the Lord to a blazing fire. In the tabernacle, the lampstand even, of the holy place was to be perpetually burning itself. It was never to go out. In the New Testament, Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews, speaks of God as being also this consuming fire in chapter 12. And of course, Jesus is our bright morning star. Back to Leviticus, the altar fire was a symbol of God's active, present holiness. No longer was this a fire that would be encountered merely from a distance in the desert or at the top of a mountain. It was encamped right in their midst. Metaphorically, maybe, I think not unfair to say, inviting them to this fire on the altar of their own hearts. Right in the midst, certainly in the heart of their community. So put yourself in the mind of an ancient Israelite, encamped about this tabernacle, day and night, you know and see this perpetual altar flame. What are your thoughts? What are your thoughts? Well, besides what you may be already thinking, I wish to consider four important things that I think God does wish to convey through this perpetual altar fire that he wanted his people to be in remembrance of. This is in your notes and the handout in your bulletin. Firstly, I think it reminded the people of their access to God's presence. God's presence. And what comfort this must have offered. As Christians, I would hope that you know, not just intellectually, but experientially, God's presence in your life. One of our favorite verses, certainly my favorite, so if I could impose that upon us, royal we this morning, it is one of my favorite verses, and I thought it led so beautifully into this study of Leviticus, which we've entitled Draw Near, God's invitation to draw near. Remember, Revelation 21:3 says, the dwelling place of God is with man. The dwelling place of God is with man. Do you believe that? Do you know that in your heart? When do we have access to his presence? Always. I think I heard an always out there. When do we have access to his presence? Always. It might have been my wife's voice even, was it? It was. Pastor Andrew read from Psalm 23 earlier in our call to worship. Even though I walk through the valley of death, I fear no evil. You are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Do we believe it? Through trials, God is with us. Listen to a couple of verses, just a couple from Isaiah 43. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned. Why? For I am the Lord your God. Fear not, for I am with you. God doesn't say, you know, I see you're entering a trial. Good luck with that. See you on the other side. As Matthew records in his gospel, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Somewhere your life is in there, okay? Even till the end of the age. He's with us in trials. When we feel weak, he's with us. Thinking of Jeremiah. He was called and he was afraid of his calling. He was afraid for his youth. He didn't know. He was trepidatious of where he'd be sent. Would they follow me? All these things. What did God say? Do not be afraid of them, for I am with you to deliver you. He never leaves us nor forsakes us. Now, I think it's worth mentioning that the Lord's proximity to you is not necessarily directly proportional to your sense of his proximity to you. Does that make sense? The Lord never leaves you nor forsakes you. But this sense of God's withness in trials or in your uncertainties and your anxieties just doesn't happen because you're a Christian. Jesus did say, "My sheep hear my voice," but we're also told that there are many voices in the land. Are you attuning as a sheep to his voice? What voice are you heeding? What are you listening to? Paul said, "There's a grace toward me, but I'm praying." He prayed that God's grace to me would not be in vain. And that's my prayer for myself. It's certainly my prayer for you as a congregation, that his grace toward us collectively would not be in vain. I can remember 1 week, this was a long time ago for some of you. Some of you, this is just a drop in the bucket. You're of that age. I think it was 1994. So many of you know I've had heart issues. You don't maybe know the history of them. Even when I was still in my 20s, I had my first sort of electrical issue with my heart. Well, that Monday, I was doing devotions, and I was in Philippians reading chapter 4 and reading the part about be anxious for nothing, right? In all things, in prayer and supplication, let your requests be known to God. Right? Well, this was, I felt a weightiness, not a fearful weightiness. I just a sense of God telling me this is important. Stay here for a bit and put it in your heart. Rest in this. I didn't know why. I wasn't facing anything tumultuous at work. I didn't have any reason to believe this was just going to be a nice regular week. At the time, I was working for a downtown firm in Kingston, but also lecturing at Queen's University. And on the Thursday of that week, I believe it was, I was walking across the park and suddenly felt, something doesn't feel right with my heart. I had a hard time getting through the lecture. And you know, I probably wouldn't normally have that kind of hard time, right? And my kids could say, you don't have a hard time getting through a lecture. But I had a hard time just standing and giving this, you know, 2-hour lecture. I went back to the office, attempted to just bound up the stairs the way I normally would. And at the top or at the landing, I'm thinking, I'm out of breath. I took my pulse. It's racing. Well, the first thing that came to mind, believe it or not, was Philippians 4. I was not anxious. Linda can confirm this. I was so not anxious. I drove home, told Linda about it, and then drove myself to the hospital. Now, that's probably beyond the beyond, but it does speak to, I did remember what the Lord had told me on Monday morning. Now, if I'd gone into my day's work without that time, without that devotion time, what would have been my first response? I don't know. I can't say that. It didn't happen. We can't re-engineer that. I love the concept of time travel, but we can't do that. But thankfully I had, and I wasn't anxious. And, you know, I did go through as the first of my paddlings. I think I've been paddled, 4 or 5 times in my life to just get me back into regular rhythm. And we believe this is now corrected, thankfully, thank God. But anyway, availing yourself of the presence of God, he is always there, but you've got in a sense, this is where you do need to impose yourself. You have to remember that invitation that we often mention to you, sometimes in our call to worship. The veil has been rent. The veil is torn. He's invited us to come to his very throne of grace, the Holy of Holies, to what? To find grace and mercy to help in time of need. Amen. God is always available to us. So I think he reminds us of his presence and that availability of his presence. 2, he reminds the people of the availability of forgiveness, of atonement. And this must have been on their minds. The brazen altar was the place for sacrifice, where one would offer a sacrifice to atone for sin. Upon this altar, the place of the burnt offering, this perpetual fire, must have brought the sense then of the holiness of God, but also the purifying fire. That conscious awareness of God's holiness would then, of course, bring a sense of their own sinfulness amongst the people. and the necessity then for sacrifice, that they can't just come to God on their own merits at all. They come through this sacrificial system. Of course, again, as Christians, and I trust we know this, that aspect of God is always available to us as well. It says in Hebrews 7, chapter 7, consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him. This is speaking of Christ, since he always lives to make intercession for them. 1 John 1, 9, God is faithful, right? If we confess our sins, he's faithful and just to forgive us our sins and cleanse us from all of our unrighteousness. So there's the availability always of his forgiveness. What great comfort for those first two points. Thirdly, I think the perpetual fire on the altar reminded the people of the activity of God amongst them. Now, it's unfair to ask you this since we haven't preached chapter 9 yet, but do you know what happened at the first burnt offering? Silence. What happened? Well, I'll read you 23 and 24, verses 23 and 24 from chapter 9. And Moses and Aaron went into the tent of meeting, and when they came out, they blessed the people. And the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people in the fire, and fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the pieces of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. What a fantastic opening, huh? So that's Aaron's first offering, and the very fire of God comes down to consume, to ignite and consume the first burnt offering. And don't you think that would have been on the minds of the Israelites as they passed that fire, as they saw it, as they smelt it? This was the place that God initiated. This was the place of the provision of God, the power of God, the grace and the mercy of God. They would know that they have no right to stand in this place but for God. His grace. Grace is not just a New Testament concept. And think even of the mercy and the grace shown by this, what must have been, in a sense, again, this terrifying act, fire coming from heaven and just consuming it right before them on the altar. And yet it's only the altar. The particularity of God's power mediated through his grace and restricted to the altar. John says, apart from me, you can do nothing. We see his grace and his power, of course, not just in the sacrificial system as we look backward. They saw it, we hope, but we see it, of course, through Christ. Four, it reminded the people, I think also, of the judgment of God. Now, judgment and wrath is not a popular subject. Maybe you hope I stopped at 3 points instead of 4 subpoints for this. But how could they not have been thinking of the judgment of God? Again, that consciousness of sin that they would have had, but the consciousness at the same time of God's availability, his forgiveness, and his power to forgive. I love the reaction of the people. Did you notice that? I did emphasize it a little bit. How did they react to this display? They shouted, and they fell on their faces. They shouted, and they fell on their faces. Humble, rejoicing, thankful, awe. Judgment and wrath may not be fashionable to speak of today, and sadly, even in churches. One young lady said to me, I hate going to church. It makes me feel so bad. You know, the same young lady said, I like being around my friends. They're so affirming, and I feel I can be who I am. Now, she grew up a little bit. That came to fall apart a bit. She realized, actually, they didn't accept me completely as I am. Friction came into this so tight a group. And of course, she didn't see, either she wasn't listening to the whole message on a Sunday morning. We never want you simply to feel bad. I absolutely want conviction where it's appropriate to fall upon you. And But God doesn't leave us. He never condemns us, and he certainly doesn't leave us with just conviction. He gives us the power and the impetus, the initiative even, to come to that brazen altar and receive what he has for us in the way of forgiveness. I hope nobody hates going to church because you feel bad. You got to listen to the end of the message. In fact, and I've said this to this young woman, what I love about the gospel is I can actually see myself as I am. I don't have to have some pretense either before you or especially before God. I can see myself as I am and know that I am accepted by my God, created for good works, preordained that I should walk in them. The perpetual altar fire of God pointed to God's powerful, eternal, ever-available presence. Our access to it, his forgiveness, his activity in our midst, God is at work. I wonder how much we miss because we don't have a physical fire burning in the middle of our sanctuary or in the middle of town. You might say it would be easy to believe in it. It would be easy to walk through those trials. It would be easy to work through the misunderstandings I have or the weaknesses I feel, the insecurities I have, if I could see that perpetual fire, if I had that proof. You know, in the e-bulletin on Friday, I related this story. I love this story of the two disciples. These are not the 12 disciples. These are two other disciples of Christ, early followers. After his death, they were walking on the way to Emmaus. Luke records this in chapter 22. And Christ comes alongside. I love the language even in Luke. He says, Christ draws near to them, walks alongside. They don't recognize him. It's not actually until he reveals himself to them that that the scales fall off, if you will. And they recount to one another, did our hearts not burn as he explained to us the scriptures? Did our hearts not burn? That's what Jesus wants to ignite in you this morning. If he feels distance, if his word feels different, distant to you sometimes, if his holiness seems like a bridge so way too far for you, he wants to burn as that altar fire in your heart continually. I'm going to end with a fairly, I think, simple hymn. Even though it's old language, it's a great hymn from Charles Wesley. And then I'll have the worship band come up. O thou who camest from above, the pure celestial fire to impart, kindle a flame of sacred love upon the mean altar of my heart. There let it for thy glory burn with inextinguishable blaze, and trembling to its source return in humble prayer and fervent praise. Jesus, confirm my heart's desire to work and speak and think for thee. Still let me guard the holy fire, and still stir up thy gift in me. Ready for all thy perfect will, my acts of faith and love repeat, till death thy endless mercies seal, and make my sacrifice complete.